Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Farmers Insurance versus Murphy.
May it please the court. Mr. Bill Boyce will present argument for petitioner. Petitioners will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'd like to start off by and hope will be an undisputed proposition that Texas law will not allow an arsonist to recover benefits directly or indirectly from the intentional destruction of insured property. I think that's our starting point, and the issue before the court today is to apply this precept in a situation where you have a couple of important factors. The insured property at the time of the fire, claim, and denial was community property. The insurance proceeds, therefore, were community property as well.
I mean, you could have sold an insurance policy that would have covered arson.
That's correct.
And did this insurance policy exclude arson?
It excluded fraud, which encompasses arson. It's got a specific exclusion
for fraud, and the policy says that includes arson.
The policy does not say in express terms that that includes arson.
Did you raise a fraud as a defense coverage?
Yes.
Did you get a jury finding on it?
We got a jury finding that the property was intentionally destroyed by Mr. Murphy, and that, we believe, brings in a couple of different ways to address this issue. One is under the common law. One is under the policy language itself.
How does intentional destruction of property equate with fraud, legally?
I think it gets there because the whole basis for arson is to recover insurance proceeds on the basis of something that is not an accidental fire and is therefore fraudulent. It's an intent to get a recovery when there's no title to it. And we would submit that that's what brings that in.
Can you stretch the law a little bit to get there?
I don't think so, but I also want to make sure that my position here this morning isn't cubbyhole in terms of the fraud, because that's one argument. But I think the decision from the First Court of Appeals and the way it was approached there, what brings us here this morning is the public policy issue under common law, separate and apart from the policy provisions. That's one aspect of it. But the real issue here is applying the rules regarding denying benefits to arsonists in this community property context. Whereas
why wouldn't the starting point in the analysis be whether or not the policy would exclude coverage? Why wouldn't we start at that point before we would get to the common law? Look at the contractual relationship between the parties.
I think that is one logical starting point. In all honesty, this issue sort of picks up where Kalubis left off, this court's 1986 decision in Kalubis. And in Kalubis, the analysis was phrased more in terms of the public policy and the common law issues rather than the contractual liability or the contractual terms issues. So I think that's where the focus of the Court of Appeals was, and that's where the focus of the analysis has been. And I think that that's where the Court of Appeals sort of got hung up in terms of what the public policy is and what it should be.
You want us to assume that, but for public policy, then the innocent spouse would recover under this insurance policy?
No, I do not ask you to assume that. It is our position as an alternative argument that the specific exclusion under the fraud provision of the contract as to you and any insured encompasses the finding that arson was committed, and that exclusion itself is an independent basis for contending.
Doesn't fraud under Texas law require an affirmative misrepresentation? In most circumstances, sometimes a failure to disclose, but in most circumstances an affirmative misrepresentation.
Frequently it does, Your
right.
Honor.
Then looking at your exclusion and looking at the proof at trial, was there proof of affirmative misrepresentations or misrepresentations of material facts?
I think that it's more in the nature of non-disclosure in terms of that there was no disclosure that the arson had been committed by Mr. Murphy.
So what you're really relying on is the concealment language then in the exclusion. They concealed a material fact, is that?
I think that for purposes of this case, both of those get you to the same place. And that under the policy language, if that's where the court wishes to focus its attention, that the recovery is properly denied to Daisy Murphy. I think...
Counsel, what about Article 2119 of the insurance code, which seems to void the fraud clause unless the insurer proved at trial that there was a misrepresentation of material fact that misled the insurance company?
I think what that is going to is more of a situation where you've got proofs of loss submitted, for example, that are inflated and that are otherwise used in an attempt to try to inflate a claim. I think that this situation has got different aspects to it because of the arson aspect to it. And what we're not talking about an inflated proof of claim. What we're talking about is the public policy of Texas and whether, because of the community property interest that existed at the pertinent times in this case, Texas public policy is going to allow a recovery of insurance proceeds by the arsonist's spouse, given that the arsonist himself has an interest in those proceeds at the pertinent times. I think that's the focus of it here, and I think that the Fifth Circuit's decisions in Norman and Webster appropriately analyze that public policy question, as recognized by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in the Kaiser decision. And I would submit to the court that where the district court got it exactly right when it entered a take-nothing judgment as to both spouses. And at the Court of Appeals, the first Court of Appeals obviously disagreed with that and reversed insofar as it awarded half of the proceeds to Daisy Merton. And we submit that was error.
To me, this question is sort of backwards. If the clearly
Mr. Murphy's wife is an insured under the policy, right? Because she's relative. She's a relative.
She wasn't.
He's actually insured. Mr. Murphy's insured. She is one of the beneficiaries because she's named in the policy. I mean, she's covered by this.
She has an interest
policy.
That's protected by
that's
the policy.
That's protected by the policy. But if the insured defrauds the insurance company, it voids the policy, doesn't it?
That is correct.
So why do we get into any sort of discussion about whether or not a derivative interest survives the voided policy? Seems to me it would be, the innocent spouse come say, I'm still covered because it's against public policy to exclude me from that policy. Seems to me that's the way the argument ought to go. It seems to me your argument ought to be, it's against public policy to pay her, your argument ought to be it's voided. And they ought to be up here arguing, well, that's against public policy.
Well, that is our position. And in honesty, we've approached it from a couple of different angles because in the case law in Texas and elsewhere, courts have approached this from several different angles. One of those angles is to look at it from pure common law public policy point of view, which is where we started off on, and which is, I think, where Kalubis was coming from. A separate way to look at it, which I understand, Justice Enoch, to be sort of the way you're thinking about it, is in terms of if the policy language results in coverage being voided, then end of inquiry. And I think that's an equally valid way to take a look at it. Frankly, I don't think up till this date that that's the way that the Texas courts have looked at it. That's certainly the way that other courts of appeals and other community property states have looked at it. And that's a perfectly legitimate way to go about it. Sort of what it is is addressing the reasonable expectations argument, which is what it's language that crops up in Kalubis. It's the first court of appeals sort of seized on in reversing the district court's take-nothing judgment as to Daisy Murphy. The notion being that there is some reasonable expectation of her ability to recover proceeds, even if her arsonist husband's receipt of those share proceeds is foreclosed due to his arson.
Well, but you can't make that argument in the face of this exclusion clause of concealment or fraud, can you? I'm trying to make that argument and there's the policy sitting in front of me and says my husband or me, how can I make that argument? I got a reasonable expectation. I can recover.
That's our point, Your Honor, that there is no reasonable expectation of coverage in light of this policy.
Well, I'm still concerned about what Justice Gonzalez raised, that you have to put on evidence and get a finding of that, and it doesn't seem to be in the charge or in the judgment. That finding based on this exclusion, even though you argue arson is included.
Well, I understand and I'll try to make the distinction that I'm trying to draw a little bit clearer. I think the anti-technicality statute, the Article 2119 issue that has been focused on here, is going to be a situation, again, where we're talking about an inflated proof of claim or something like that, where it's something after the fact.
Can I answer your argument by saying, well, this is a 100% inflated claim because they're really not entitled to anything because their arson is not covered. So if I put in a claim for $100,000, I've inflated it by the whole figure. I don't think that's a good viewpoint.
I think that there is a difference when you're talking about arson and the claim being void ab initio because of the fact that it results from arson, and the claim that there was some kind of post-loss inflation of the proof of loss.
Well, there's a
like
post-loss statement by the husband when he filed the claim that this was an accidental fire because he omits saying, I did it, which is a material fact that's concealed, isn't it?
I think it's more in the nature of a statement, you know, I don't know who burned the house down.
Isn't that why you have the fraud language in there? For instance, if the cause of the fire was arson, and had it been you who set that fire, they would have been able to recover the proceeds, correct?
Correct.
And isn't the reason why you have fraud in the contract is because it's only when the arsonist is the one who submits the claim that results in the fraud that would prohibit you having to pay on the claim.
Correct.
So, let me ask you, this bothers me. If he had come in and said, the house is burned down and I burned it down, then you say, well, there's no fraud, so it's covered?
No.
What would you say?
No, the position is that as a matter of public policy, but let's talk about it in two terms, outside of the contract terms and within the contract terms. Outside of the contract terms, as a matter of public policy reflected in Kalugas and cases before and after, the arsonist is not going to be permitted to recover, period. Bolstered by the provision that I've pointed to the court with respect to the fraud, and that is a species of fraud, and it's a species of fraud that's not really so much aimed as at misrepresentation as it is that it is improper and not going to be permitted to allow arson recovery, an arsonist to recover benefits after intentionally burning the insurer's property. I hope that answers the question, because I really am trying to come down squarely on both sides of the issue. I think that as a matter of public policy, we prevail. I think that as a matter of the contract policy language, we prevail. And I think those are alternative ways to go about it.
Doesn't public policy also dictate that an innocent party to the situation should be entitled to recover?
Where, up to where we are right now with Kalugas, is that in a separate property situation, that is an accurate statement of the law, Justice Abbott. And the difficulty or the issue before the court in this case is the one that Kalugas said we are going to reserve for another day. Well, today is the another day, because it is the issue of how do you treat it when there is a community property interest in the insurance proceeds? Because
that would be true, for instance, if they had not gotten a divorce and had the property not been separated.
And that raises the timing question. And let me address that with you. I think that the public policy issue that arises here is that if it's community property, the arsonist has an interest in those spouse's proceeds, regardless of the spouse's culpability or lack of culpability in connection with the fire itself. You say, in response to that, a community property interest when? And I think that's the point where the Court of Appeals seized on and said, well, there was a partition agreement filed after the claim was denied. It was filed on the eve of trial. And then 7 months after the trial, just before judgment got entered, there was a divorce decree that was signed. Those actions purported to separate the property interests, and therefore we don't need to deal with the public policy issue that Kalugas raised but did not resolve, because they were separate property, the insurance proceeds going to Daisy Murphy property by the time it came judgment time. I would submit to the court that the proper way to analyze this issue is to focus on the facts as they existed at the time of the claim, the time of the fire, the time of the claim, and the time of denial, that the universe of facts that exists at those time periods is the one that should be looked at.
So if they got divorced before the fire, you'd lose?
If they got divorced before the fire, and if there was no indication that the effort to separate property interests was collusive, then the spouse would get the insurance proceeds.
Despite what this provision in the policy says?
Independent of what the provision of the policy says. I'll come back to the policy language in a moment. I'm talking, in answer to your question, Justice Heck, purely on the common law approach to it. I'll come back to the policy language, because again, I want to draw that distinction that these are alternative grounds and alternative arguments.
But do we even have to get to that analysis about whether or not they were married, whether or not this is community property or separate property? Should we look at the reasonable expectations of the spouse here and whether or not we should infer knowledge upon her about that provision and insurance policy that if either one of them commits fraud, that it avoids coverage?
I think that that is an appropriate way to approach the issue. Again, it can be either or. It's either a public policy. And the reason I keep coming back to public policy is I think that's where Texas law is right now in terms of how Kalubas framed the issues. If in this case this court wants to encompass within the analysis more of a focus on the policy language, then of course this court is entitled to do so. I'm not sure that the court has really done that to date. And so that's why I've approached it first from a public policy standpoint and then from the policy language standpoint.
You mentioned three dates that you feel are important in the determination of this kind of case. Which one is the most important and why?
I think that probably the date of the resolution of the claim, the denial of the claim, is going to be the operative date, because that is the date at which the investigation has been conducted, the facts have been investigated and found, and the parties and everybody at that point is going to be on notice of what the situation is.
How was this, what date was submitted, I've forgotten, to the jury in this case? The date of the fire?
There was no specific date submitted. The way that this was submitted was
defining what an innocent spouse was and said, was she or wasn't she?
Correct.
But the only date in the charges, I recall, did he commit arson on the date of the fire, is that right?
That is correct.
So when did she have to be an innocent spouse under that submission?
Well, part of what's built in, and there's a sort of an assumption there that I think about whether or not the jury was allowed to consider the effect of the partition agreement. Do I understand that?
No, that's not what you question? Said. There's three dates. All of them precede the litigation. All of them, at least under the facts of this case, are precede any business about partitioning and divorce and so forth.
Well, I think the question is this. There wasn't a specific date built into the innocent spouse question, but in effect there was, because it said, do you find that she was an innocent spouse? More properly, do you find that she was not an innocent spouse? Mm-hmm. Put burden on us.
Right.
And you're just instructed that an innocent spouse means that she either participated in the fire or knew about it beforehand. So I guess that takes
before
it up to the date of the fire.
Right, so if that's what you think the inference was, then your viewpoint that the date of denial is not the best date.
I think the
because
date
the jury was asked a different question and could draw different inferences from what you suggest.
I think that the date of the denial, really where the date of denial comes from is the Norman and Webster analysis of the issue in terms of addressing the question of whether a post-arson separation of property interests is going to be allowed to have some impact on the decision about how the spouse's insurance proceeds are treated. So I think that's where that comes from. And I think what that does is allow for the investigative period of the claims handling to be undertaken to see what are the surrounding facts and circumstances. Does it look like it was an arson fire? Is there some indication that that this married couple is divorced, getting divorced, separating property interests, whatever? It allows a little bit broader snapshot of time to look at some of those issues. So it wasn't really tied specifically to that jury question.
So the real issue here is you want, I think the legal system wants to prevent, say, a couple from perpetrating a fraud by causing their house to burn down and then getting a divorce so that they will be able to collect at least half the value. But what if you have a situation and you come up with a rigid test that you perhaps are offering where what happens is that the wife says she's leaving the husband. Husband gets mad and says, well, I want money. I'm going to burn down the house to get money and to pay her back. And she goes off to Kansas for a month. He files a claim the next day, and within a month, the insurance company denies the claim. After investigating it, she comes back and says, where's the house? Where's the money? And she doesn't get a recovery, despite the fact that when she comes back, she promptly files for divorce, and after the adequate time waiting period, she gets her divorce.
No, I understand your concern, and I guess what I would gently take issue with is the notion that the rule that Texas Farmers has proposed as a matter of Texas common law talks about the facts and circumstances as they existed. And I would submit to you that if the court has some concern that applying a common rule is going to result in some harsh results in that hypothetical or others that could be devised, that if the rule is phrased in terms of the surrounding facts and circumstances, then that can be taken into consideration. If you're talking about a situation where there really are no indicia of collusion, if you've got or an abusive spouse situation or some kind of forcing of conduct on someone or something like that, that can be accommodated. So I would submit to the court that if you've got concerns, that you can come up with situations where you say to yourself, gee, that just doesn't feel right, that doesn't feel fair, I would respond to you that the rule we put forth leaves enough flexibility that can be addressed. What rule we proposed here today is designed to do is to avoid a situation like the one that we're present in here, where there is no indication of any of those kinds of concerns, but what you do have is a post-arson eve of trial effort to separate the property interests.
Well, whose viewpoint does this test apply from? The insurance policy, or the carrier, or the so-called innocent spouse?
Well, you've got reasonable expectations language in Kalubis, and I think that suggests reasonable expectations of the insured, so I think that's a factor that this court has said this is one of the things that's got to be taken into the mix. I think the larger question is the perspective of Texas public policy as a whole, and whether there is going to be allowed to be room for indirect recovery of benefits that arises because of this community property circumstance. So I think there's more than one perspective, that the standards, at least as the issue has been framed by Kalubis, there's more than one perspective that has to be taken into consideration.
I just want to be sure I understand you. Your position is that if the spouse, in this instance, thinks she really should recover, and she's sympathetic enough, you're going to waive your policy provision?
No, sir.
Well, I'm not following.
And it may be that I haven't drawn the distinction clearly.
If she's going to lose under the policy, what difference does the public policy make?
Two separate issues.
Okay.
If this court decides that it is going to address this issue solely in terms of the policy and contract language, then that's one inquiry. I don't understand that to be where the court is today, but that's one approach to it, okay?
Why do you not understand that's where the court is?
Because there's no discussion of that in Kalubis, which has teed up this issue, but then left the community property aspect of it open for resolution at a different time. I don't understand that the court's decision in Kalubis makes a focus on the policy language any kind of significant part of the analysis. Now, maybe I'm not...
It's your position it shouldn't be.
I'm sorry?
Is it your position it should not be a significant part of the analysis?
I think that it should be a part of the analysis, and I think that...
Well, should it trump or not?
Should it...
Trump.
I think that if the policy language is clear and explicit, then it would trump. If the policy language is not clear or not explicit in the court's view, then where you go is to the public policy consideration, and then we're going to take a look at it and
What's your position on whether this is clear?
I submit to the court that it is clear and unambiguous that the any insured language, as demonstrated by the cases that have been cited in our brief on the merits, do indeed encompass any claim to proceeds by the arsonist's spouse.
And that's because arson is a public policy issue that voids the policy, and he filed a claim having failed to identify himself as an arsonist, and therefore it violated the fraud provision of this policy, so this contract is now void.
It's void under the contract language, and separately and independently, his claim is void as a matter of public policy.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Court will now hear Tom Bartlett for respondent.
I think foremost, this court needs to be aware of and consider the importance of this issue that this court is going to consider today, not just from the context of Daisy Murphy, who lost all of her property and now is in a situation where she is not going to recover any proceeds to reimburse her for that loss, but also for all the other future women, innocent spouses, who will find themselves in this position in the future.
You haven't focused very much either on the policy provision.
And Judge, and there's a good reason why. The two concepts, the policy and the contract, are interrelated. But in this situation, I don't believe that the contract analysis can be put before this court, or that this court can decide this case on a contract analysis, because there was no contract, no policy ever issued.
Your client pleaded policy.
You're suing on the contract.
We are suing on the binder and the application. There was two different pleadings filed. There was a pleading filed by Robert Murphy. There was a pleading filed by Daisy Murphy. The standard form that was attached was never issued and was just offered to reflect what the commission, the insurance commission, has approved. That doesn't necessarily mean that in this situation the insurance company would have issued this or was required to issue this. That merely sets the minimum standards by which the policy that is ultimately issued will be judged by. But the fact remains that in this case, there was an application made on September 23rd, 1993. The fire happened 7 days later. The cancellation notice was sent out October the 11th, 1993, canceling the policy coverage effective November 12th of 1993, and no policy was ever issued.
So if you buy insurance and you burn your house down quick enough before the policy gets issued, then you can have the benefit of the policy but not be bound by the terms of the policy.
I think that is when we fall back to the public policy analysis, which I think will kick in. Now, there are
isn't that basically your position? If the house had burned down the day after the policy was received in the mail, then you'd be bound by the terms? But your point is that because there was only a binder and the fire occurred so quickly, the jury found here arson, I guess, was the cause of this fire. That if you burn your house down quick enough, you don't have to worry about the terms of the policy, and you can fall back on public policy arguments to decide whether or not you have coverage or not.
Your Honor, I believe that you're confusing the analysis between the arsonist and the innocent spouse. And I think it's
No, I'm trying to determine the legal effect of the insurance policy, separate and apart from who is trying to recover.
It, of course, depends on what policy is issued. The majority of the jurisdictions that consider this issue, and I have them cited in my brief, hold that if there is any ambiguity, in terms of whether or not the exclusion under the concealment issue, the act of any insured borrowing or coverage for any other one, will not be enforced in the event of ambiguity. That line of cases, the majority position, assumes that there has to be a policy issued, and the reason being very clear, it ties back to the Kulibis decision and virtually every other decision that has addressed this issue, is the reasonable expectation of the innocent spouse, whether it be determined by the circumstances or the written language. Now, if there
Let's
is
Let's back up to the contract issue.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there any dispute about what kind of policy would have been issued had the house not been burned down?
It would be they contracted that a form be a homeowner's policy.
So, and we know what the terms of that would have been. There's no dispute about that.
We know what the State Insurance Commission has promulgated as a minimum. We do not know for a fact what it would have been.
Well, doesn't the binder say that? Doesn't the binder say that a policy is going to issue in accordance with a particular form and so that it's all part of the binder?
I think that it says the binder does not permit them to limit the coverage to the form required by the insurance commission. It requires them to issue a form that provides that minimum coverage. They, of course, are entitled to change that.
And give more coverage than what the binder indicates.
Yes, if they so choose.
Not less.
Exactly.
But in the binder, there appears to be, as a result of that, an expectation on the part of both the insurance company and the insurer that they should expect a homeowner's Form B policy to be in the mail.
There is an expectation of coverage. There's an expectation that it is covered for 60 days unless canceled otherwise.
And it's covered under the same terms as homeowner's Form B.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
I'm just trying to understand the effect of the binder and where we are in terms of, as Judge Allen is, what do we do with this contract?
What we do with this contract, there's one of two ways that this court can go. If this court wants to follow the majority of jurisdictions that have considered this issue, the court can make the determination that there is no policy issue that was in the possession of Daisy Murphy that would otherwise affect her reasonable expectation of coverage. When you look at Kubelis and the many, many, many other cases that address this issue, you look at the perspective of the innocent spouse. Did she expect that her property
Let me short circuit this. You keep talking about Kluber's, but there was a policy in effect there, correct? Kluber's doesn't address the issue. What do we do here where there's a binder and the policy had not yet been sent? So
yes, there was a policy.
Kluber's has nothing to do with the issue that we've been talking about here for the last few minutes. Assuming that we disagree with you and we say that the terms of Form B are the contractual parameters that we deal with, don't we have to strike down as void against public policy the fraud provision in this contract as to Daisy?
Oh, absolutely not.
And why is that?
Public policy is a completely different issue, Your Honor. There's two ways to conduct the analysis. One is the contract analysis. If you look at the contract that's actually issued and take the position that this written document defines the reasonable expectations of the party. If there is ambiguity, would then you resolve that against the insurance company and assume there's coverage. That's one way. The other way, and there are a line of cases that hold, despite the terms of the written policy, public policy recognizes the importance of protecting the innocent spouse.
So we have to, in other words, let me put it very squarely, assuming that we disagree with you and we conclude that the concealment or fraud provision is not ambiguous, that it applies to Daisy Miller, and that on its face she is another insured and cannot recover under the literal terms of the policy, the unambiguous terms, then aren't we, you left with an argument that because a public policy in Texas about community property and a spouse's interest, that that provision is unenforceable and against public policy as applied today?
Yes.
So we have to strike down that particular part of the policy as applied to an innocent spouse.
If you assume that that policy was issued and bonds are, and I take issue with that, then you still have to take the position that in Texas, as a matter of public policy, an innocent spouse should be bound by the terms of the policy and should not have the protection contemplated in Kubelis.
Kubelis was construing a policy, was it not?
Kubelis did not analyze the policy. Kubelis' decision was came from the time when the harsh traditional rule of forfeiture was applied, presumably on the theory of oneness, that if the husband did it, the wife's going to go down with the ship. Texas says, at that point, the majority of jurisdictions have abandoned the traditional rule and have opted for the new majority rule, under which the intentional destruction of property by a co-insured will not affect the right of an innocent co-insured to recover, and that upon a jury finding of innocence shall be permitted to recover. That is the public policy principle addressed in Kubelis, and the majority of other community property jurisdictions that have considered the issue. The issue posed in Kubelis, the problem was it was a destruction of a trailer given to them by the parents, and being a gift of separate property. The court went on to hold in Kubelis, because the wrongdoing spouse has no legal entitlement to the insurance proceeds awarded to the wife, we're going to allow recovery. They then go on and say, we are not presented with a situation involving community property. That will be another day, but do say that we are not to be considered a hold that in a community property situation, the innocent spouse should be barred because it's community property. They pose the question, essentially, that it's not a question of if the innocent spouse should recover, it's a question of how to permit the innocent spouse to recover and yet not permit the wrongdoer to benefit from his wrongdoing. And that is the principle behind the rule adopted in most community property jurisdictions and separate property jurisdictions that allow an innocent spouse to recover.
What's your definition of innocent spouse?
An innocent spouse is one who does not have knowledge nor participate in the causing or setting of the fire. The exact issue that was submitted to the jury and is not in dispute of Texas.
What if the spouse knows nothing about the fire and doesn't participate in it, and not related in terms of the policy, thinks, great, I'm going to get to recover, and maybe even the arsonist thinks they're going to recover because they're going to be able to convince the jury or whatever, and then further down the line, the couple gets together and says, why don't we divorce and partition this? We can at least get 50%. I'm going to get hung out to dry on the arsonist thing. We'll go our separate ways till you collect the money. Is that still an innocent spouse? If after the fact, not having participated in it, there is an effort to collude with the arsonist to collect at least half the proceeds of the policy?
Judge, that's a very difficult question.
That's why I want to know what an innocent spouse is.
I don't think that affects the finding of innocence. I think that goes to the issue of collusion that Texas Farmers asked this court to adopt a very restricted time frame because of the possibility of collusion. I would suggest to the court that when this very court, in Price versus Price and the other cases that did away with the interspousal immunity, was faced with a very similar question, is that we should deny the abolition of the interspousal immunity because it's going to lead to collusion. And the court said, in Price, as in Googler, that the trial court is uniquely situated to address the issue of collusion. So I would suggest that there may be situations where that's going to arise. But I suggest to the court that the overkill that Texas Farmers is asking this court to adopt to exclude any recovery for that remote possibility does not strike a reasonable balance, an appropriate balance, taking into mind the true harshness and the tremendous burden that is going to be imposed on the innocent spouse. And the Kugelis case is a prime example. Kugelis arose from the fact that the husband lost his control when the wife filed divorce. His burning of the property was not to collect insurance proceeds. It was aimed at her, and situations like this arise. In one of the other cases I cited, Howell, I think it's the New Jersey case, the arsonist husband was convicted of attempted to murder his wife in the fire. Those situations arise. The real problem that I have with Texas Farmers' proposal, and I think this court really needs to think about this because I didn't put it in any reply, two things. One, it confuses the issue. The Kugelis situation court says that you look to see how to compensate the innocent spouse and yet not permit benefit. The Court of Appeals properly did that. The Court of Appeals held that in this situation, at the time of judgment, there was not only a partition, but there was also a divorce, very similar to the situation presented in Travelers versus Wolf. They want to ask this court to adopt the rule for the purpose of removing all indirect incentives for the husband to commit arson. I suggest that is improper when you balance that against the burden imposed on the wife. More significantly, their proposal is not workable in terms of time. They make a couple contradictions. One, they say that after the fact maneuvering must be disregarded, and do this in reply brief. Then they say that the innocent spouse should be afforded a reasonable opportunity to protect herself as long as it is at the beginning of the proceeding. In this situation here, the fire occurred on September 30th. Claim was submitted 60 days later, and it was denied January 21st, 1994, about 112 days from the fire. Now, they're asking this court to adopt the position that contract partitions are collusive, shouldn't be considered. We have to have the severance at the beginning of the proceeding, therefore a judicial proceeding as suggested by the courts in Norman and many other jurisdictions. That's not available. The only other alternative in Texas to make community property separate is to get a divorce. They're asking this court to adopt a rule that would compel an innocent spouse to protect herself to get a divorce, but the real problem is that it's not workable. first in terms, it assumes that she knows the husband did it. What if she has no idea? No, honey, I don't know who did it. What if she suspects that maybe he did it? Should she then run down and file a divorce in hopes that she can get divorced before the insurance company denies the claim? In this situation here, they denied the claim in 112 days from the date of the fire. Did she have time to get a divorce? I said yes, that she did. What happens if she thought that her husband did it, ran down, did get a divorce, and the jury says he didn't do it? It's overkill.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Barlow. If this court determines that the contract is unambiguous, that the wife is excluded because the insured committed a fraud, are we arguing that public policy voids that provision in the policy as to the innocent spouse, or are you arguing from the standpoint that you're assuming that the provision is ambiguous, and therefore we have to decide whether she's covered or not?
It's not an either or. I'm arguing both, Your Honor. I'm saying that if it's ambiguous, the public policy is clear that I should win. If the court finds that it was not ambiguous somehow, even though no contract was issued, I suggest to the court that the Kublitz decision controls and is not enforceable in the community property state because the Court of Appeals then run down and file a divorce in hopes that she can get divorced before the insurance company denies the claim. In this situation here, they denied the claim in 112 days from the date of the fire. Did she have time to get a divorce? I said yes, that she did. What happens if she thought that her husband did it, ran down, did get a divorce, and the jury says he didn't do it? It's overkill.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Barlow. If this court determines that the contract is unambiguous, that the wife is excluded because the insured committed a fraud, are we arguing that public policy voids that provision in the policy as to the innocent spouse, or are you arguing from the standpoint that you're assuming that the provision is ambiguous, and therefore we have to decide whether she's covered or not?
It's not an either or. I'm arguing both, Your Honor. I'm saying that if it's ambiguous, the public policy is clear that I should win. If the court finds that it was not ambiguous somehow, even though no contract was issued, I suggest to the court that the Kublitz decision controls and is not enforceable in the community property state because the Court of Appeals held that at the time of the entry of judgment, the innocent spouse could be compensated and the wrongdoing spouse could not benefit. So I think that it's in both situations, the public policy issue has to be addressed.
Are you conceding that arson constitutes fraud as that term is used in the contract?
There is no specific arson exclusion in the contract. Other jurisdictions, they do have an arson exclusion. In Texas, there is not an arson exclusion. I think that the exclusion that we're talking about, the fraud and the concealment, it goes to the concealment. I think Justice Gonzalez was right, is that you need to have the allegation, submission, and finding that the concealment...
Let me try to do this one more time. In the part of the policy that says the policy is void as to you and any other insured, if you or any other insured under this policy has intentionally concealed or misrepresented any material fact or circumstance, made false statements, or committed fraud relating to this insurance. What I want to know is what your position is on whether or not arson constitutes the commission of fraud as it is used in that phrase.
The courts have held that provision does include arson. there are other jurisdictions that deal with a reasonable expectation, dealing with that particular language, say that to have it be enforceable, it needs to be somehow brought to the attention of the innocent spouse so as to truly and meaningfully affect her reasonable expectation, whether it be brought to the front of the policy or in bold letters or something to that effect. There are cases that address that issue. But it goes to the reasonable expectation of the insured as a basis to deny coverage.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Following up on the questions from Justice Abbott and also Justice Hankinson and Gonzalez earlier, I want to try to give you some comfort that fraud does indeed encompass arson, and I would direct you to the decision that was discussed in Kalubis. I think this part of the case is still alive and well. This is the Jones versus Fidelity case that Kalubis discussed. If you look at the bottom of page 281, top of page 282, I think you will see there that it is treated as fraud, as a species, arson as a species of fraud, and it's got nothing to do with misrepresentations or reliance or anything. It is fraud for the purposes of insurance contract provision. And Justice Abbott, I think that fits with where I think your question was going, is that the provision itself draws a distinction between misrepresentations or fraud, which suggests that it's not one and the same thing or completely overlapping. But I want to step back on the policy language aspect a moment to just drive home the point, and it was suggested.
Can I ask you really quickly, how does this policy language square with Kalubis? If I have separate property, personal property that's in my house, and my husband burns the house down, and you say that arson then is this condition two then covers arson, and if I'm an any insured, I guess I don't get to recover for my separate property either under the terms of this policy.
If
how does that square?
If our situation involves separate property, then I think that would be an issue, and that may be something that's going to have to be addressed in another case where whether or not this public policy discussion in Kalubis really does trump that or not. I would submit to you that for purposes of this case, we're dealing with community property, and that the public policy
well, I understand
and
we're
the
dealing,
policy
I understand are, we're dealing with community property, and since we don't have a discussion in Kalubis about specific policy language or anything, it would seem that if what you're saying, that this is a valid condition in the policy, Kalubis in the face of this homeowner's policy would not live anymore, because if I'm excluded from recovering because I'm an any insured and my husband burns the house down and gifts that I was given
right,
are
your
in there, then I'm lost. My separate property is gone and it's not insured.
Part of it is a question of how this court wants to approach the issue. Does the court want to approach it from a strict public, a strict policy contract interpretation point of view? Does it want to approach it from a purely public policy point of view, divorced from the policy language, or does it? Is it going to try to make the two intersect and peacefully coexist? And I will grant you, there is some tension there. There really is when Kalubis departs, in my view, from a discussion of policy language. And I want to drive home the point, which I think was perhaps suggested by your question, Justice Owen, with respect to whether or not the policy applies here, because the policy was canceled before the policy was actually issued. I come back to the point. I look at I look at Mr. Murphy's petition. I look at Mrs. Murphy's intervention. They sued us on the policy. They invoked the policy. And more specifically than that, they invoked the terms and conditions of the policy. And I would submit to the court that on this record, there really is no wiggle room for Mrs. Murphy to contend that it is somehow unfair or improper to assess her reasonable expectations on the basis of a contract that she invoked and that she sued us on. I'm not going to berate the point other than to also mention that there is, based on my review of Mr. Murphy's petition or answer and counterclaim, Mrs. Murphy's intervention, there's no pleading of ambiguity. ambiguity has never come up in terms of this specific policy provision. In the cases that are cited in footnote one of our brief on the merits, I think provide ample authority that the any insured language is unambiguous. So I just want to put that point to rest.
In that regard, let me ask you something. The policy that you issued to the plaintiffs in this case was issued after the fire, correct?
Chronologically, the binder was issued, the fire occurs, policy is canceled. The binder contemplated that the Texas Homeowner Policy Form B was the contract that issued. I'm not sure that the record shows that they physically had it in hand at the time of the fire.
You're answering part of my question. On the binder that they received before the fire, it said Homeowner's Policy Form B.
Correct.
Okay. And then they received, after the fire, the policy that had all the explicit terms in it, like
correct.
What we're talking to about the fraud and all
correct.
That. Here's my question. The policy in Kalubas was actually worded different than the policy here. The policy there said that the entire policy shall be void if, whether before or after a loss, the insured has willfully concealed or misrepresented, da-da-da-da-da. It talks about the insured as opposed to the language in this case where it talks about you or any other insured. Arguably, there's some
that may be a basis for distinction, and Justice Hankinson, that may go to your question in terms of the insured has been interpreted to encompass only the arsonist as opposed to the arsonist's spouse.
Okay, well, here's my question.
Okay.
At what year was this policy issued to the plaintiffs in this case?
1993.
In 1993, were you all issuing any homeowners policies that use language consistent with the language used in Kalubas?
As I stand here, I don't know the answer to that. I can certainly try to get that answered for you, but I can't answer that. Co-counsel informs me that the answer to that is no, but I'm not sure that that's reflected in the record.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's argument. The marshal will adjourn.
All right.